Broadcasting from occupied Wangunk territory, this is Horizontal Power Hour on WESU Middletown. Welcome to the 37th episode of Horizontal Power Hour, broadcasting from the studios of WESU Middletown, 88.1 FM, all the way to the left of your dial. Horizontal Power Hour is your source for anarchist thought, culture, and politics. We air on the second and fourth Tuesdays of each month at 4 p.m. Horizontal Power Hour alternates with Indigenous Politics from Native New England and beyond with Jay Kaholani Kawanui. So make sure to check out Indigenous Politics next week at 4 p.m. This week's edition of Horizontal Power Hour features excerpts from a presentation by the radical Mexican development critic Gustavo Esteva. The talk was titled Beyond Development and Globalization, Anarchy and Buen Vivir, originally given in Middletown, Connecticut, a few weeks ago, February 13th, in Russell House. Esteva describes himself as a deprofessionalized intellectual and a grassroots activist. His writings have, for the past 25 years, figured centrally into what is now called critical development studies. He works both independently and in conjunction with a variety of Mexican non-governmental organizations and grassroots organizations and communities in Chiapas, Mexico, including the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, or the EZLN. In this talk, Esteva emphasizes the terminal inadequacy of prevailing political priorities and illuminates the radical potentiality of what he calls the ongoing insurrection. In addition to the wise words of Gustavo Esteva, we will play some less wise words of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia in his dissent in the landmark case Lawrence v. Texas, in which he refused to agree to strike down Texas anti-sodomy laws. And as always, we bring you a roundup of action news from around the world that didn't make the corporate media industrial complex. Stay tuned! Part one of Gustavo Esteva's lecture is coming up here on Horizontal Power Hour on WESU Middletown.
Hola, adultos. Tengo a contarles algo que tal vez les sorprenda. Los monstruos no existen. La verdad, eso de que hay seres peludos que hacen bu y que se esconden debajo de la cama, no lo cree nadie. Además, ahí guardo mis juguetes y no hay mucho espacio. Los monstruos son solo una excusa para poder dormir con ustedes porque su cuarto tiene tele. Pero aunque no existan los monstruos, hay algo que sí nos da mucho miedo. Algo que puede estar en cualquier lugar de casa. El plomo de la pintura. ¿No queremos enfermarnos por él?
Cada año, más de 1 millón de niños se envenenan con plomo y sufren daños irreversibles en su desarrollo físico y mental. Si tienes hijos menores de 6 años o estás embarazada y tu casa fue construida antes de 1978, es muy importante que sepas qué hacer. Manda un mensaje con la palabra plomo al 30364 o visita libredeplomo.org para obtener más información. Un mensaje de The Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD y el Ad Council. Cargos por mensaje de texto pueden aplicar.
Up to 50% of the food produced in the United States is wasted each year. Meanwhile, the number of people who experience hunger and food insecurity continues to grow. Food Not Bombs is a worldwide movement that recovers perfectly safe and edible food that would otherwise be thrown out and redistributes it in our communities. For over 15 years, Hartford Food Not Bombs has shared free public meals every Sunday at 3 p.m. in Bushnell Park to protest war, poverty, and hunger. For more information or to get involved, call 860-978-3562. That's 860-978-3562. Or email us at hartfordfnb hartfoodfoodnotbombs@gmail. Hartford Food Not Bombs. Because food is a right, not a privilege.
Welcome back to Horizontal Power Hour here in WESU Middletown. Coming up, part one of a lecture by Gustavo Esteva, development critic, entitled Beyond Development and Globalization, Anarchy and Buen Vivir.
We all are in a radical situation everywhere. A radical situation is a collective awakening. The collective awakening defining the radical situation requires time to ripen, its own time, its own calendar and geography. In a radical situation, autonomous liberating initiatives tend to predominate over demagoguery and fatigue. Imaginations repressed for a long time wake up. What was considered normal now seems like sleepwalking. The emperor's nakedness becomes suddenly evident. Alerting calls usually appear at the beginning of a radical situation. The Zapatista basta, enough, fulfilled that function in 1994, but we must remember that the first day of Occupy Wall Street, basta, enough, was there as a sign of identity. A radical situation is a spring of novelties. It produces here and there solid constructions that can be destroyed but not corrupted. It also produces fascinating creations which often endure. But the tack of the protest, which is evidence of the awakening and becomes contagious, cannot be predicted. Even in those cases like the current case, in which to continue sleeping becomes almost impossible, and the awakening begins to take the shape of a rebellion. Yes, we need to understand what is happening, the roots of the current situation, but understanding is not enough. This is a call to our senses. We need to feel it and to have the guts to digest it. How to formulate our current challenges in the pertinent way? One of the main difficulties is one of the main difficult questions that we need to address is that we are trying to cultivate a new worldview that cannot be the worldview when we need to give voice to a broad range of views from many parts of the world, from many philosophical and spiritual traditions. We are living in revolutionary times. If you want to keep in your backpack one single idea of your 2 hours tonight here, perhaps you can keep with you the idea, the hypothesis that there is an ongoing insurrection. Now, today, everywhere. Try to see it. Try to experience it. Try to see if it is here where you are living, or it is only in my mind. Is there really a new uprising, an ongoing uprising? Perhaps we are not seeing it because we have the old eyes and the old eyes are now useless. Then we need to open really our new eyes to see what is happening. But what is revolution today? The very idea of revolution, the idea which started with Pope Gregory VII in the 12th century, that was the first attempt of total reform of the world. That old idea that has defined all the shapes of the revolutions in the last 200 years, that idea is over. Yes, that was the shape of the American Revolution and the French Revolution and the Mexican Revolution and the Russian Revolution and all these revolutions of the last 200 years. But that idea of revolution is over. We are also at the end of the Leninist paradigm, the paradigm that dominated the political life in the whole world in the last century, for the last 100 years. It implied A, The assumption, this is a very important point, the assumption that people don't know what to do. And because they don't know what to do, they can do what is needed. And this is the basic point of the Leninist paradigm. People don't know. Then they cannot do what is needed. And then the second element is then because the people know that you don't know, then you need to create an ideology, you need to create a purpose, sense of purpose, a program, and then you need to create an organization to achieve that purpose, and then you need to seize the state, and once in the state, you will start organizing the whole change. It is what is usually called the social engineering for social change. It is, of course, Stalin and Mao and Fidel Castro and all these leaders, but it is also Franklin Roosevelt and President Reagan and Mrs. Thatcher. It is everywhere the same paradigm. It's social engineering. Then we have an idea, we have a purpose, we have an ideology, and then we seize power, we are at the top of the power, and then we organize the changes from the top down. That has been in the world, dominating in the world for the last couple of years, everywhere from light and right and left, etc. Today, we are reclaiming sense of proportion. We are no longer pretending that we are gods, that we know the absolute truth, and that we can lead the whole everyone in the right direction. The most radical statement of the Zapatistas has been, we, the Zapatistas, that for some of the most important radical thinkers of the world, like Chomsky or Wallerstein and all of them, they are saying the Zapatista initiative is the most radical and the most important political initiative in the world today. And all the anti-systemic movements acknowledge that the wake-up call, the moment in which they got a different call to do something different, was the call of the Zapatistas. Well, the Zapatistas, these incredible people, the Zapatistas, they say, we are but ordinary men and women. And then they say, because we are ordinary men and women, then we are non-conformists, we are rebels, we are dreamers. Beautiful, we can say, but really? That fat woman coming out of Walmart with stupid groceries, it is a dreamer, it's a rebel, she really a non-conformist? Yes, said the Zapatistas. What you have in real ordinary men and women, you have this rebellion. It can be manifested in daily behavior, or it can be latent, hidden in the daily behavior, in manipulated behavior. But it is that. It is basically the time for ordinary men and women that it is the stuff with which every revolution is made, has been made all the time. But we have here a very old problem. If people can express, the people, these ordinary men and women, can express their will democratically, without manipulation and control, most people will vote for things that would socialists would call petit bourgeois preferences. Some pornography, more sports, more TV than readings, what you can find in a popular journal. And it's an image of what the people seem to want. The socialists, at least in Europe, solved this problem in a very simple way. An elite should lead the people towards a better understanding of the problem. This looked satisfactory and was appropriate for very simple things. But in all the rest, the elite becomes corrupt. And the only way to control such corruption is to stop being elite, to open the system to the people. But then the people bring to the decisions attitudes that are ethically, aesthetically, and philosophically unacceptable. How to escape from such cycle? One idea is to accept that people need to learn what to do after so many years of manipulation, and you need to teach them the process. But that is populism. And the best populism, but populism also failed. apparently we are in dead end. We don't know what to do. For a century we were trapped in the ideological debate between capitalism and socialism, and we stopped thinking. And we don't know what to do now. One pertinent answer was given by the occupiers in Wall Street. When they were asked by many journalists all the time, which are your demands? And the answer was all the time, demands? You can't present demands if you believe they can satisfy them. But we know they cannot satisfy them, then why to present demands? Then which are your proposals, they were asked. And they say, we don't have proposals, of course. But we also know that they don't have proposals. And then what is needed is a very good democratic dialogue among all of us to discover what to do, to discover, to create true consensus, through a democratic procedure, to create our proposals. That is the problem. That is what we are doing. We are really at the crossroads. We are at the end of an era. The world is falling apart before our eyes. We need a change. But people don't jump blindly into the unknown, into uncharted territory, unless they have hope. And then what we need is to nourish people's hope. Hope is the very essence of popular movement. The movement exists because there is hope. And we cannot take for granted that everybody see right now the nakedness of the emperor. Many people see him still clothed with all the clothes constructed by the politicians, the intellectuals, and the media. We have been lacking both imagination and practical examples of alternative France. But in 1996, at the end of the intercontinental encounter convened by the Zapatistas, at the very end, when you have 6,000 people there, activists, leaders of very movements of 70 countries, ready to come together and to do everything to change the world, then the Zapatistas, at the very end of the encounter, they came and said, we're not here to change the world, something that is very difficult and perhaps impossible. We are here to create a whole new world. Oh, great, this is wonderful. But after the end, out of place, we're saying, well, yes, great, but that's too romantic. That is not practical. We are living here, not in Mars. We cannot create a new world right now. But this is, we discovered months later and sometimes years later, that is a very pragmatic statement. Yes, you cannot change this world. It is very difficult, next to impossible. But you can create tomorrow morning a whole new world. And apparently it is exactly what is happening today. We were postponing for years the creation of worlds, the worlds in which many worlds can be embraced. And we were thus unable to present a real alternative, illustrating what we think. Most people are no longer interested in another discourse, another critique. They need to see that other worlds are possible and necessary.
And welcome back to Horizontal Power Hour, broadcasting from the studios of WESU Middletown. You just heard part one of two of a lecture given by development critic Gustavo Esteva. After the break, you'll get some action news from Dan and Zach, and part two of Gustavo Esteva's lecture entitled Beyond Development and Globalization, Anarchy and Buen Vivir. Stick around, we'll be right back.
Get away!
and Zach here with your action news, and here's Zach with Today in History.
On this day in history, in 1864, in the so-called United States, the first contingent of 14,000 Navajo reached Fort Sumner, New Mexico during the Long Walk of the Navajo, a 400-mile forced march in which thousands died. The Long Walk of the Navajo, also called the Long Walk to Bosque Redondo, refers to the 1864 deportation and attempted ethnic cleansing of the Navajo people by the U.S. government. Navajos were forced to walk at gunpoint from their reservation in what is now Arizona to eastern New Mexico. Some 53 different forced marches occurred between August 1863 and the end of 1866. The term Long Walk includes all the time the Navajo were away from the land of their ancestors, who had arrived there in the 16th century, according to Western anthropologists.
And more recently, March 5th, 2012, five Lakota were arrested Monday evening in Wamble, South Dakota, when they formed a blockade to halt a convoy of trucks going through the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. At issue there were two trucks that appeared to be hauling pipes through the reservation on their way to Canada. The pipes on their way from South Korea were to be used in the tar sands pipeline. A Canadian company apparently wanted to avoid paying taxes in the state of South Dakota, which is roughly $50,000 per truck. So instead, they had the drivers use roads on the reservation. Some 75 Lakota thought otherwise. The two trucks, marked oversized load, had in convoy several pickup vehicles that were first spotted in the late afternoon. Once alerted about the convoy and its whereabouts, Alex and Deborah Whiteplume decided to go and stop it. They were joined by others who formed a human blockade. The human blockage halted the trucks. The Whiteplumes were told by the truckers that they had corporate authority to utilize BIA roads. There are actually a number of laws that should protect Indian tribes from those who cite corporate authority, said Charlotte Black Elk, a well-known attorney activist from Menderson, South Dakota. Whiteplume and his wife and three others were arrested and charged with disorderly conduct and taken to jail in Kyle, South Dakota. The Ogallala Sioux and all American Indian tribes in South Dakota have adamantly opposed the Keystone XL pipeline that was routed through the Pine Ridge Reservation and Rosebud Indian Reservations that would cross Ogallala Sioux rural water supply system in two places.
Fresno County authorities are offering $100,000 for information leading to an arrest in a January arson attack, California's biggest beef processor. Sheriff's officials announced the reward Tuesday. The January 8th fire destroyed 14 big rig tractors and several trailers at Harris Ranch near Coalinga. Harris Ranch estimated the loss in excess of $2 million. Animal rights activists claim responsibility for the fire through an anonymous email released by the North American Animal Liberation Press Office. The email included a description of the containers of accelerant and kerosene-soaked rope apparently used to set the blaze. Sheriff's investigators have declined to comment on whether the group's description matches details from the investigation. Officials say they have not identified any offenders yet.
And a group fighting for a greater share of Nigeria's oil wealth in the country's Delta region has claimed responsibility for the killing of four police officers late last week. The Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, MEND, said in an email that it sent to reporters on Friday that it shot the four police officers who were on a boat patrolling the Nembe River in Bayelsa State on Thursday. The attack is the second assault in about 4 weeks. The police attack comes about a month after MEND claimed responsibility for an attack on an oil pipeline in the area that is operated by the Italian firm Eni Spa. Before the recent pipeline attack, the group had remained relatively quiet for a number of years following a ceasefire. The two attacks raise fears, among some, that MEND, which once crippled Nigeria's oil supply with a wave of attacks targeting foreign oil companies, could be remobilizing. The statement also raised concerns about MEND's ties to pirates.
Tuesday afternoon, the international police organization Interpol announced the arrest of 25 alleged members of Anonymous by officials in Argentina, Chile, Colombia, and Spain. Shortly after the announcement, Interpol's website was hit by a distributed denial-of-service attack. At the time the story was posted, the website remained unavailable. Interpol announced that the arrests were made as part of Operation Unmask, an international effort launched in mid-February to grab the perpetrators on attacks on websites in Colombia and Chile, including the Colombian Defense Ministry and presidential websites, a Chilean electricity company, and Chile's National Library. Officials also seized 250 pieces of equipment, including computers and mobile phones, during a search of 40 locations in 15 cities.
Over to Taiwan, Aboriginal activists sent up smoke signals in late February in a symbolic action demanding that the government make amends for wrongful policies against indigenous peoples and create a new constitution that includes all who live in Taiwan.
Ceremonies memorializing the February 28th incident are used by Han Chinese members of society to monitor ROC government efforts towards transitional justice, but nothing has been done to redress 300-year-long persecution of Aborigines, said a spokesman for the Smoke Signals League, an organizer of the event. The February 28th incident refers to a local uprising in 1947 against rampant corruption, expropriation of property, inflation, and commodity shortages in which government troops killed thousands of people. The League presented three demands: correct wrongful policies concerning Aboriginal land rights, speed up legislation to make the requirements of the 2005 Indigenous Peoples Basic Act, and establish a new constitution taking the rights of Indigenous Taiwanese into account. The annual relay of smoke signals began at 10 a.m. in eastern Taiwan's Taichung County and was taken up by 46 Aboriginal communities throughout the island. Participating groups this year included Paiwan tribesmen supporting the protection of the Pingtung counties along the ancient trail from a highway development, and Amis defending their traditional fishing grounds in Taichung and Hualien against improperly planned resorts and tourism facilities.
One of the world's largest ever strikes began at midnight on Monday, February 27th, and ended at midnight the 28th. Up to 100 million Indian workers from different sectors and industries are calling for a national minimum wage, permanent jobs, and much more. Over a dozen of India's largest trade unions have called for and signed up to the strike. The strike will affect many sectors, including public sector banks, ports and docks, railways, insurance, road transport, energy workers, miners, and aviation workers. Recent months have seen a mounting wave of militant worker struggles in India. Strikes for union recognition in India's expanding auto sector, including a two-day occupation of a Hyundai plant, a wildcat strike by Air India personnel, and walkouts by telecom workers and coal miners against the central government's privatization plans. The different unions have a variety of different demands. They include getting the same rights and protection for temporary and contract workers that permanent workers have, raising and extending the minimum wage, resisting the attacks on trade unions, stopping price rises, the creation of a national social security fund, increase in pensions, and combating corruption. The workers are demanding a national minimum wage, permanent jobs for contract laborers, social security for informal laborers, pensions for all workers, intervention by the government to stop the rising costs of living, and to end the sell-off of publicly owned companies, amongst other demands. Transport, postal services, and banking have all been hit by the strike, which involves around a dozen unions, with a complete shutdown of banking in Mumbai being reported. Police have been deployed to try to prevent unlawful picketing, with 100 arrests made this morning for obstructing traffic.
And in case you're just tuning in, this is an Action News Roundup on the Horizontal Power Hour, 88.1 FM, WSU Middletown. Some exciting news from Europe. In Sweden, according to a number of news reports, a well-known mink farm in Skyberga was attacked on February 26th. A small number of mink were released from cages and breeding cards were destroyed. The farm has been targeted by the Animal Liberation Front several times already in the past.
And for more than 20 years now, the No Tav people have been struggling against the construction of the Turin-Lyon high-speed railway. No Tav, the abbreviation in Italian of No al Treno Alto Velocita. This resistance was born in a small Alpine valley and has now become a symbol of strength and determination against the perverted powers of the market. Sabotage, direct actions, popular meetings, and direct control of the territory are some of the strategies of resistance of this movement, which has managed to stay united in spite of all the attempts at splitting and criminalizing it that power has tried against it. No Tav men and women have responded with even more strength to all the attacks that the Italian state unleashed in order to take possession of their land. They didn't surrender after the eviction of the resistance camping, known as the Free Republic of Maddalena, or after the repressive wave that threw 25 comrades in jail because these comrades tried to block the construction of a useless and damaging work which only obeys to the logic of economic profit. And in the past week or so, the No Tav campaign has called everyone to join them on a big demonstration in the valley. Thousands of people, 75,000 or more, united once again in their refusal of the government's terror tactics against the movement. Also, a sabotage operation was conducted on Saturday against the SNCF lines in Savoy, causing quite a mess on this day of crossover to the ski resorts. Now some news from New Orleans. Wendell Allen was murdered yesterday by the thugs in blue of the New Orleans Police Department. He was unarmed. He was a star basketball player. He had his whole life ahead of him. While the outcome of his encounter with the police may have been especially tragic, his story is far from unique. The new Jim Crow system of justice put his body on an all-too-familiar path on a collision course with the fear-inspired bullets of the NOPD thugs who broke down his door last night. The entire story of Allen's interactions with the justice system reflect a perfect example of the new Jim Crow in the way that Professor Michelle Alexander defines it in her new book of the same name. From Wendell Allen's criminal record for minor offenses, especially drug offenses, to the trap of probation violations, of non-payment of exorbitant fines due to poverty leading to further warrants and arrests, of kids with criminal records being second-class citizens when it comes to employment, leading many to turn to the black market economy to survive, and it led to his unjustifiable murder by Officer Josh Calcloth.
That's from New Orleans. Speaking of new Jim Crow, on December 16th, 15 prisoners working in the kitchens at Central Prison in Raleigh, North Carolina, sat down on the job in protest of hours, lack of gain time, and working conditions. Prisoners in these kitchens are made to work 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. The strikers refused to go back to work until questions were answered regarding their hours and gain time. Instead of addressing their concerns, the head kitchen's corrections officer told the men to get off their sorry butts and go back to work and called in for backup. This is the same facility where a scandalous media report on conditions in the mental health ward forced Warden Branker into early retirement. Despite the peaceful nature of their protest, guards soon came and threatened the men into returning to work. Eight of the men, however, continued to refuse to work until their questions were answered. These men were charged with disobeying a direct order and work refusal and were placed in solitary cells. Just a few days ago, the men were given an abrupt disciplinary hearing in which they were railroaded into ICON, short for intensive control, as punishment. ICON is an intensive form of segregation, typically 23 hours a day in small solitary cell with few, if any, resources, constantly censored mail and little recreational activity. Sentences in ICON can last 6 months or longer. The men who refuse to return to work are calling themselves the Strong Eight and have been in touch with outside support groups to spread news and ask for solidarity in their struggle. It is clear that the attempt to isolate and repress these men's strike is an effort to intimidate any efforts at organizing on the inside before they start. The struggle to get these men off of solitary is about more than just the freedom of these eight men. It's about the use of solitary confinement as a tool for political intimidation, prisons as a form of forced labor, and the new Jim Crow of the contemporary prison industrial complex. And we'll wrap up this action news with some more from where we've heard so much from lately. This is from Chile. On June 1st, 2011, you've heard his name on this show before, Luciano Tortuga, a 23-year-old, put a bomb in an empty Santander bank in Santiago, adhering to the anti-authoritarian offensive that had been developing for years, attacking direct symbols of the state and capital without recognizing borders or leaders. This March 20th, 2012, will start the trial against the comrade who lost both of his arms in the accident. And he is risking 15 years in prison under the anti-terrorism law. Supporters in Chile write, "We cannot stand silently watching as they judge our brothers, destroy the logic of capital, defend our comrade and his insurgent act with all imaginable forms of attack in the war against power."
Here's another report from Argentina. Gendarmería, local and Buenos Aires Federal Police, civilian brigades, anti-terrorist laws, biometric identification systems, thousands of cameras throughout the city, vigilant citizens ready to betray, overcrowded jails, torture, murder. This is the scenario where our struggle, in a context similar to many other cities, attacking comrades, individually or collectively, without any social consensus and without the approval of any leader, alone and with their principles and values, burn like a fire. For our part, we report that on Thursday, March 1st at 2:30 in the morning, we attacked with an explosive incendiary device the criminal court in Calle Paraguay in the city center, causing visible damage to the facade and their windows.
And we don't have time to get to it in full attention now, but their student protests, perhaps a student strike, our plan to continue are continuing as we speak in Montreal and other parts of Quebec. A student protester may lose vision in one of his eyes after being hit with shrapnel from a police stun grenade. Expect to hear more on this in upcoming programs. Zach's got a quick final bit from Middletown.
Yes, this past Thursday here at Wesleyan University, the Hugo L. Black Lecture for Freedom of Expression, named after a Supreme Court justice who was once a member of the Ku Klux Klan, Justice Antonin Scalia delivered the keynote address, a speech on his originalist philosophy of constitutional interpretation, which many comrades allege is a cover for repressive conservatism. He was greeted with protesters outside from Occupy New Haven and Occupy Hartford, which chanted against his Citizens United decision and also against his racist, homophobic, and sexist policies. Also outside, students and other protesters distributed leaflets detailing the oppressive nature of Scalia's decisions. And inside the lecture, students dropped banners, one of which read, "There can be no justice in the court of the conqueror," and "We the People Incorporated," with corporate logos on the faces of the founding fathers. Other protesters inside tossed condoms onto the audience with messages affixed to them that read, "This stops more abortions than Scalia," and "Practice safe sodomy." Other students wore black hoods and orange jumpsuits while standing silently in protest of Justice Scalia's authorization of Guantanamo Bay torture policies and indefinite detention.
And now, some words from Justice Scalia himself in his infamous dissent in the landmark Supreme Court case Lawrence v. Texas, which struck down anti-sodomy laws as unconstitutional. Luckily for you, you don't have to listen to Justice Scalia's droning voice. Don't worry, we spruced it up a bit. Thanks for listening to Horizontal Power Hour on WESU Middletown. Back in a moment.
My dissenting opinion responds to the particular legal points made by the court. I would like to summarize here just a few general considerations. The Texas statute at issue here undeniably seeks to further the belief of its citizens that certain forms of sexual behavior are, as the court says, quote, immoral and unacceptable. That is the same interest furthered by criminal laws against fornication, bigamy, adultery, adult incest, bestiality, and obscenity. Bowers held that this was a legitimate state interest, preventing sexual behavior that the society believed immoral and unacceptable. The court today reaches the opposite conclusion. It embraces instead Justice Stevens' declaration in his Bowers dissent that, quote, the fact that the governing majority in a state has traditionally viewed a particular practice as immoral is not a sufficient reason for upholding a law prohibiting the practice. Close quote. This effectively decrees the end of all morals legislation. One of the most revealing statements in today's opinion is the court's warning that the criminalization of homosexual conduct is, quote, an invitation to subject homosexual persons to discrimination, both in the public and in the private spheres. It is clear from this that the court has taken sides in the culture war, and in particular in that battle of the culture war that concerns whether there should be any moral opprobrium attached to homosexual conduct. For many Americans do not want persons who openly engage in homosexual conduct to be partners in their business, scoutmasters for their children, teachers in their children's schools, or boarders in their home. They view this as protecting themselves and their families against a lifestyle they believe to be immoral and destructive. The court, however, views it as discrimination, which it is the function of our judgments to deter. So imbued is the court with the law profession's anti-homosexual culture that it is seemingly unaware that the attitudes of that culture are not obviously mainstream. That in most states, what the court calls discrimination against those who engage in homosexual acts is perfectly legal. That proposals to ban such discrimination under Title VII have repeatedly been rejected by Congress. That in some cases, such discrimination is mandated by federal statute. such as the federal statute mandating discharge from the armed forces of any service member who engages or intends to engage in homosexual acts. And that in some cases, such discrimination is a constitutional right, as we have held with regard to the Boy Scouts of America. Let me be clear that I have nothing against homosexuals.
If you're just tuning in, this is Horizontal Power Hour here on WESU Middletown, 88.1 FM, all the way to the left of your dial. Horizontal Power Hour is your source for anarchist news, thought, and politics. For the rest of the hour, we'll play part two of development critic Gustavo Esteva's lecture delivered at Wesleyan University on February 23rd, entitled Beyond Development and Globalization, Anarchy and Buen Vivir. Thanks for listening.
We lack imagination. We have been unable to imagine the alternative. But we were so concentrated in the critique of what is wrong in the world we don't want that is falling, that we were unable to imagine, live, and share with others the new world beyond it. But not all of us, common people, ordinary men and women, all over the world, sometimes struggling for sheer survival, some other times reclaiming old ideas, ordinary people are taking the initiative today. Let's see some examples. The great Uruguayan poet Galeano wrote a beautiful, terrible poem called Global Fear. And he says at one moment, in these times of global fear, we are now again afraid of hunger. Many people are afraid of hunger. 1 billion people tonight will go to bed with an empty stomach. 1 billion people. They are afraid of hunger, of course. And, said Galeano, the rest of us, 6 billion people, are afraid of eating because we know what is in our place. Now, we cannot declare ignorance. We know that they are poisoning us, that all the food that we can go and buy everywhere, it is full of poison, that all our bodies are full of poison served in our plates. This is the problem. What to do before that very real, urgent problem? We know that some people are dying of hunger, some other people are dying because they are eating. What to do? To present a demand? Obama really tried to dismantle the subsidies to agribusiness. Impossible, no way. The system is there. Four companies are controlling 80% of the world trade of food. What to do? Begging the corporation, beg to the government, present our demands to change this terrible system that is created after the highest crop in history, billion people in hunger. What is happening? What is there? All around the world, there are people in despair, but there are an increasing number of people full of hope. Hope is the name for dignity. All over the world, we are smelling hope, exploring hope, instead of falling into despair or apocalyptic randomness. It is an adventure into unknown territory. But the title of this talk, invented by Emily, includes anarchy in the title. It's a combination of anarchy and living well. To help me in this specific territory, I can call for the help of our beloved Howard Zinn. His purpose as a historian was to rescue the innumerable small actions of unknown people which produce the greatest social changes. Even marginal gestures can become the invisible roots of social change. And that is exactly what is happening. Anarchy, said Zinn, disturbs most Western people because it is associated with disorder, chaos, violence. We are afraid of those conditions because we have been living in them for a long time, but we have not been living in anarchist societies, which have never existed, but in the powerful nation states, which are so afraid of anarchism. There is no other moment of history, said Zinn, with more social chaos. And it is precisely this kind of conditions that the anarchists attempt to eliminate. They want to bring some kind of order to the world for the first time. Yes, I am explicitly saying that anarchy means order, not chaos, not perturbation. The great American anarchist, Paul Goodman, came once to Cuernavaca to visit work village like many other radical thinkers in Sidog 40 years ago, and then he was presenting his arguments about law. And then suddenly he was interrupted by an American student and said, "How you dare? We come here to listen to your theories, to your ideas. You are the greatest anarchist today in the world. And how you dare to talk about the law and to celebrate the law and to organize all this talk around the principles of the law?" And then Paul Goodman started to cry. That was his immediate reaction. And then after he composed himself, he said, "Only a good anarchist, serious anarchist, really know the importance of law, the real meaning of law. But our law, of course, not the law imposed on us, the law that we create, the norm of being together. Ilich wrote once, men, people, are born in language, that is how we become human, and can use symbols for our relations. Live in law and die in meat. We cannot live without norms for our coexistence. We need these norms. That is the important point that the anarchists are trying to make. We need the norms, real norms, our norms, to live together. If we think in contemporary terms today, and we associate anarchists with a struggle for freedom and self-government, that is, with people that pretend to govern themselves in freedom, rejecting external imposition of higher powers, I can say in a provocative way that this is fully embedded in the original American dream. The images presented in many Westerns, where the people themselves are in power, when the people take the decisions and real men and women, ordinary people, reclaim control of their own lives, are, in my view, embedded in the original American dream. What I see in this country today is a very radical process. It is not only the radical situation, that collective awareness that we see everywhere, we are experiencing everywhere. It is a peculiar process to reclaim the original American dream, transmogrified into a nightmare by the progressive corruption of your ideals. As Ivan Illich once said, "Corruptio optime quae specima," the corruption of the best is the worst. Apparently this happened here. You corrupted the best, and then you got the worst. And then what you are trying to reclaim now is that best that you lost in the process. Tom Paine and Thoreau were not anarchists or Marxists, but they were Americans, very Americans. In this country, there were very clear reservations about the central government and a courageous decisions to keep the power in the hands of the people, to have a real democracy, not a representative democracy, as Madison and Hamilton discussed it. Right now, we can see basically a lot of confusion. A week ago, after accepting his defeat in Maine to Romney for a close margin, Ron Paul told his followers, "Remember, the revolution is just beginning." We can assume that the revolution he is talking about is not the same described by Marx when he examined the Paris Commune and he celebrated the dismantling of all the state apparatuses. Anyway, we need to be aware that this is also the moment of danger. On the one hand, radical situation, when the people is not fully awake, all kinds of demagogues may occupy the dreams. Competent politicians may capture their impulse and bring them back to the old way. On the other hand, violence may dominate the picture at any moment, as we are seeing, and nobody knows the outcome of such violent confrontation. But what I am experiencing at the grassroots, what I am smelling every day, is an ocean of hope. Hope, friendship, surprise. This is what I am perceiving everywhere in many different social movements around the world. Yes, in the Arab Spring, yes, in Greece, yes, in Plaza del Sol in Madrid, yes, in London, yes, in the south of Mexico, yes, in the whole of Latin America, yes, in the United States. I cannot conceive, imagine a better way to conclude this talk, but quote again our beloved Howard Zinn, a very American guy. The anarchists, he wrote, see revolutionary change as something immediate. It is something that we need to do today, right now, wherever we are, where we live, where we work or study. It implies to begin right now to get rid of all the authoritarian and cruel relations between men and women, parents and children, between different kinds of workers. This is not an armed uprising. It happens in the little corners which cannot be reached by the powerful but clumsy hands of the state. It is not centralized or isolated. It cannot be destroyed by the powerful, the rich, the police. It happens in a million places at the same time, in the families, in the streets, in the neighborhoods, in the workplaces. Suppressed in one place, it reappears in another until it is everywhere. Such revolution is an art. That is, requires the courage, not only of resistance, but of imagination. Yes, that is the idea, and that is what I think is happening today everywhere.
Does it for this week's episode of Horizontal Power Hour here on WESU Middletown. If you'd like to know more about Horizontal Power Hour or to hear our entire archive of 37 episodes, please check us out online at horizontalpowerhour.wordpress.com. Also, for relevant updates throughout the week on action news and anarchist thought, please take a moment to search Horizontal Power Hour on Facebook and like us. Listen back in at 4 p.m. in 2 weeks for the next episode of Horizontal Power Hour, and tune in next week at 4 p.m. for Indigenous Politics from Native New England and beyond. Up next is the Jive at 5, your daily source of goings-on here in Middletown, a community service of WESU. Thanks so much for listening. Robert Kennedy Jr., our mothers.